Okay. So the topic I was given for this evening is this: dwelling in the middle. How can we avoid the extremes of views? That's a big topic, isn't it? We could spend a lot of time just talking about that, but we'll spend a small amount of time talking about that and have some conversation. So most of you here will know that the Buddhist path, the Buddha Dharma, is often called the middle way, the way between extremes. And so what's being suggested here is that this path, this middle path, has on the side of it two sorts of extremes, or a set of extremes, and we're winding our way through what those extremes are. And intuitively it sounds good, doesn't it? Let's avoid extremes, let's not get too excited about things and so forth. But there's actually a lot more in it than just going, oh yes, that sounds okay, that's the middle path, that makes a lot of sense, I'm a Buddhist, I'll walk the middle path. There's a lot more to it than that, and that's what we're going to investigate a bit this evening. First of all, walking is an activity. It's an activity of skill. Have you ever watched children learning to walk and how often they fall over? It's quite instructive, but you know, it doesn't come naturally. They have to practice. And walking a path, sometimes quite a difficult path, needs practice as well. And the other thing to notice about children when they're learning to walk is that they might get upset, but once they've had their little burst of tears, what do? They get up and they start walking again until they've got the skill. I think sometimes as we grow, we lose that skill of maybe having a little fit or a burst of tears or being a bit angry, whatever it is. We go, oh, I'm not going to bother, you know, I'll just give up. So skill takes time to learn. And so to walk this middle path takes some degree of skill, some degree of thoughtfulness as well. So a quality right from the start of generosity and kindness to ourselves and some determination is really important in learning to walk this path. Hopefully we're on the path, but we need to find out where it leads and how to skillfully navigate the path. There are lots of paths. We want to walk the middle path. So one of the things I want to consider tonight is, why would we do that? What does it actually mean? It sounds good, but why? Unless we're motivated, we're not going to do it. It might sound good and we'll come to a talk and think, yes, great, that's fantastic. We walk out the door and it disappears again. So it needs to feel like it's got value for us, which means we need to have thought about it a bit to understand what that value might be. So the Buddha said about this, this is from the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, one of the earliest suttas spoken by the Buddha, the turning of the wheel of the Dharma. He said this: there are two extremes that are not to be practiced by one who has gone forth. Which two? That's a very good question to ask, isn't it? Which two? That which is addicted to sensual pleasure, with reference to sensual objects, base, vulgar, common, ignoble, unprofitable, and that which is addicted to self-affliction, painful, ignoble, unprofitable. So on one hand, it's being addicted to things that are very pleasant, and the other one is being addicted to things that are painful. And the Buddha says either of those extremes are unprofitable, not worthwhile. But I just want to point out one thing here, that in that first sentence the Buddha says there are these two extremes that are not to be practiced by one who has gone forth. So we need to be really clear that this is a teaching addressed to monastics. So we can be a bit gentle with ourselves here. Nobody here is a monastic. I don't see anybody dressed in robes. So I'm guessing that there probably aren't any, unless there's a secret monastic here. But you're hiding it very well. So a little bit of caution is advised with this, because we can become extreme about walking the middle path. That also can become an extreme view. So we need to just know who this is being spoken for. It's often said the Buddha spoke for particular audiences, particular people, and pitched the conversation and the talk to the person he was speaking to or to the group he was speaking to. So the Buddha talks about addiction to pleasure or pain, and either of those is an extreme. So the question for me when I was thinking about this earlier on was, how do we know which views and desires are extreme? How would we know? I mean, it sounds obvious to start with, extreme is extreme, but what is extreme? And I tried to think of an example that might be appropriate for you guys. And I was thinking, is it an extreme view to really want an HD, a high distinction for your work? Think about it. And you might go, oh yes, maybe not. Yeah. Well, that's a desire, isn't it? You mightn't achieve it. But maybe that's not. Maybe that's okay. But is it extreme to want an HD for the next five pieces of work? Is it extreme to want an HD for every single piece of work? You know, which of those are extreme? We could make an argument for all of those things. You know, one's an extreme, one's not. We could say, no, your parents probably think an HD for everything is not extreme at all. So that struck a nerve, obviously. So it also depends on who we're talking to. Clearly, you know, you guys may be a slightly more realistic because you're at uni, but your parents obviously want you to do well, and they'd love you to get an HD for everything and come back and, you know, succeed in whatever field you choose. Well, think about money. You know, when you get out and you actually get these jobs with all your HDs, is it extreme to want 100 grand for your first job, do you think? Is it extreme to want 250,000? Is it extreme to want 500,000? Like, when do we get to a point when it's extreme? Is it extreme to want 50,000? Is it too much to want 20? We can keep going asking all these questions about what does it mean to be extreme? How much money is too much? Different people are going to give us different answers, and some will say, oh, that's extreme. You want, you know, 250,000. Really, 80,000 is fine, or the average wage is, you know, 65 or something. That's, you know, we could get caught up in a whole lot of conversation and argument about that as well. And when we do get caught up in argument, when people have differing views, how do we react to those? We might regard their views as being extreme. You know, somebody, you know, your parent, for example, might say, well, I want an HD for every assignment. We're paying for this course after all. Get the HDs. We're supporting you. But you might hold quite a different view, maybe, as I said, a more realistic view. And they might think your view is extreme, that you're simply not trying hard enough. And then, you know, if we hold different views, is it extreme to express an opinion, you know, our own opinion? How strongly can we express that opinion? Should we get into an argument? You know, should we just say no? Should we disagree? Or should we go along with them just to keep the peace? Maybe that's extreme. So it starts getting a little bit confusing, doesn't it, as to what actually is meant by extreme. There are lots and lots of different ways of thinking about it, according to what culture we're in, you know, what we're doing at the moment, who we are as people, what the topic is we're talking about. So one way of trying to manage that is we could sit down here tonight and we could start making a list of all the extreme views. And I guarantee we wouldn't be finished by it next week. Can you imagine we'd be writing on the walls, we just wouldn't be able to do it. There would be thousands and thousands, and of course, just as we've said here, there'd be huge arguments about, you know, what's extreme and what's not. We'd never get out of the room. I hope you've got some supplies in, because we'd be here forever, basically, and even then we wouldn't be finished. There's just so many views, and we have views about views, don't we? The Buddha talked about views, and he called them a forest of views, a tangle of views, a thicket of views. In other words, we get stuck in there and caught in our views. So, is there another way of coming at this? Well, the Buddha comes up with another list that's quite interesting too. And it's from the Lokavipatti Sutta. And I'll just read these pairs out of the list, out of the sutta to you. Maybe I'll read the sutta later. He talks about these extremes: pleasure and pain, fame versus insignificance, praise versus blame, gain versus loss. And says these are four fundamentally oppositional pairs: pleasure and pain. Well, that's a bit obvious, isn't it? We can see that there's a bit of an... Although some people enjoy pain, and their pain is pleasurable. You know, some people, if they have too much pleasure, they feel guilty and it becomes painful. You know, I work in palliative care, you know, and so sometimes when somebody dies, people feel relieved. And so initially that's a pleasurable feeling. And why are they relieved? Because maybe that person's been suffering. And then what comes after that is guilt. And so it's quite complex when we get to thinking about even pleasure and pain, which seems so obvious, let alone these other things we're talking about. Fame and insignificance. And the Buddha's saying we can be addicted to either of those. In fact, the modern project, isn't it, is to be famous. All these reality TV shows that are on at the moment, I mean, I use the word reality lightly there, are essentially about being noticed, aren't they? Being famous. And maybe there's some money in there as well. So fame and money seem to be very, very strong at the moment in terms of views we hold about what would be really important. You know, if only enough people can see me and admire me, then I'll get whatever it is that I need, you know, whatever it is that I need from people around me. If only I get enough money in my job, then my parents will get off my back and I'll be able to relax. You know, we can get involved in all of that sort of stuff as well, with, you know, gain and loss, fame and insignificance, praise and blame, and so it goes on. So it's a very useful list of pairs to have, but just by itself it doesn't necessarily help us clarify what to do, how to know what extreme views are. So maybe it's all getting too tangled. We're in a thicket of views about views now. We just think, get rid of all views. Views, they're a pain. I saw what the Buddha said. Get rid of them. They're hurting me. You know? So how do we do that? How might we do that? Well, look, the obvious ways that people try and get rid of things that are painful or just, you know, cause them pain is alcohol, drugs, keeping busy all the time. Suicide would be an extreme example of that. In incredible pain, physical, emotional, social, whatever the pain happens to be, to end ourselves, to finish it. And I'll come back to that a bit later. So, you know, how do we get rid of views? Given that for human beings, we seem to form views very easily, we need views about things, don't we? Very simple views, like if I push that door, it will open. If I sit down, the chair won't fall over. These are sorts of views about the world. It'd be very hard to function in the world without these inbuilt or learned types of views. And again, with children, we see that they build up various views about the world. Now, whether these are extreme views or not is another question. But at the very least, it seems that for human beings, to get rid of views is problematic. They seem to make up sort of who we are. So we might think, okay, I can be more skillful than that. Perhaps I just need to step back from views for a while. I'm going to practice meditation, concentration or absorption meditation, you know, and all thoughts will disappear. It's extraordinarily useful and far better than taking drugs and alcohol. However, we must come back from concentration meditation and we return to this world, to the world of the phenomenal, coming and going, moving, changing, and all the views we need to navigate the world. So it's a very skillful relief, but it doesn't necessarily answer the question about what's extreme and what's not and how we manage those. So all the solutions, the so-called solutions I just mentioned about, you know, taking drugs, alcohol, committing suicide and so forth, or just bombing out so we're not really present, they fall into a category that the Buddha called vibhava tanha. Vibhava tanha. Now, tanha is craving or desire. Craving is quite a good word for it, I think. And that's the desire for non-existence, for annihilation, to just get rid of the stuff that's painful. You know, I can't get rid of it, so I get rid of me in some sort of way. And its most extreme point, of course, is suicide. Most of us are going to want to keep existing, so suicide is not an option for most people, but for some, of course, it is. You know, too many people take their own lives. You know, we want things to be the way we want them to be. And we're not really ready to get rid of ourselves. We just want the world to change. I remember one of the very first therapy books I ever read. And the guy who wrote it, Sheldon Kopp, said, everybody comes to therapy wanting to feel better, but nobody wants to change. We want things to be the way they are out there, but it's hard for us to change ourselves, to shift ourselves. We like being who we are. So vibhava tanha is trying to get rid of all the painful stuff. It's the view that if I do that, it'll all disappear. The opposite of that is bhava tanha, craving onto existence, to being. And I've mentioned a couple of those modern forms of that, modern expressions of that, fame and wealth. These are ways of existing as a person, feeling real. You know, if I can just get all of you to really think this is a fabulous talk, I'm going to feel fabulous. You know, and that'll make me feel more solid, much more real, and have to have some status. You know, praise and blame. Well, I want to be on the praise end of that. So this is bhava tanha, craving after being, after existing, after presenting a self. Another example of that might be the selfie. How many selfies has everybody taken? A lot? Who's got a selfie stick? Don't put your hand up. Because praise and blame might come up at that point. Selfies are a modern project of projecting ourselves through social media, aren't they? And I'm not saying they're bad. But we see them all the time, don't we? And really, you go to the opera house and every second person's got a selfie stick. And this is very interesting from a Buddhist perspective, and I will come back to this, because we're getting closer to what helps us make up our minds about extreme views and what actually the problem is. So we need to come to, we can't make a list of things, that's too difficult, it would go forever. We can't really get rid of ourselves unless we commit suicide, and who knows if we're going to be reborn into another realm, a lower realm, or suffer on the way, or wake up and not be dead and you know, suffer even more. You know, it's a chancy thing. And we can try and bury ourselves in life and become all these things and have lots of selfies and have a huge Instagram account with lots of followers. You know, you could be the next Kim Kardashian of UNSW or something, you know. When would enough be enough, I suppose, is a question there. When would that become extreme? Would 200,000 followers be enough? 500, a million, 2 million? You know, if I can just get more than Kanye, then I'll be, you know, that'll be a thing. But that's not extreme, you know. It can go on forever. And the problem with that from a Buddhist perspective is we condition ourselves then to do the same thing. It becomes a habit. And it's often said the brain doesn't care what we do. If we repeat it over and over, we get good at it and it becomes a habit. So if we're in the habit of, you know, you getting taking selfies or trying to get a huge Instagram account or whatever, whatever the impulse is that's driving that, that becomes a habit. It becomes who we are. We practice it and we get good at it. So we can develop skillful or unskillful habits. As I said, the brain doesn't really care. If there's a reward, that's all the brain wants. The dopamine rush. And we'll keep doing it. So we want to be able to say something fundamental about the issue here. So let's cut to the chase with what I think is fundamental about this. So there are lots of ways of coming at this, but there are at least two fundamental ideas within Buddhism that I think help us judge whether views are extreme or not. And these are underlying principles of how life is. And I should say again, stop me along the way if you want to ask questions or add something, please do. It's really important. And you may have your own examples of this, and I'd really appreciate hearing about them too. So take courage and put your hand up if you want to say something. Really happy to listen to that too. So the first idea, central to Buddhism, is that we fundamentally misunderstand the nature of existence. We don't see it clearly. That's why Buddhist practice is called insight practice, seeing into how things are more and more clearly, more and more skillfully, more and more subtly, insight practice. So within Buddhism it says, no, we're not really seeing our experience as clearly as we might. And then the fact that we don't see our experience clearly leads to further suffering. That's a fundamental proposition underlying the whole of Buddhist practice. And there are many other propositions, but that's one of the major ones. And even if we do perhaps understand one of these fundamental propositions, we don't necessarily live in a way that shows we understand it. And what is that? We don't take it to heart. This fundamental proposition, which you've heard a million times in all your Buddhist talks, is the truth of impermanence, that things change. So it seems obvious, doesn't it? Like, duh, things change. I remember I went on my first longer meditation retreat a long time ago, and it was, 30 days. And it was really hard, really difficult, really hot. There were lots of flies. Didn't really know what I was doing. There's a lot of pain. And I came out of it and went back down to Melbourne where I live. So it was up here in Sydney. At Wat Buddha Dharma, if anybody knows Wat Buddha Dharma, at Wiseman's Ferry. And I went back to see my parents. And I was a bit high from the whole thing, I think, and probably a bit sleep-deprived as well. And my parents said to me, you know, so, Mike, what's this Buddha stuff about? And I must have said something like, oh, it's about the fact that everything changes. And I think they looked at me and just went, yeah, they didn't say this, but I think the look in their faces said, really, you could have stayed home and we could have told you that. Kids know that, right? Yeah, even young kids from about 7 or 8 onwards, they know that things change. The question for us, though, really, if it's so fundamental to Buddhism, what's the issue? The issue, in part, is that we don't necessarily live that way. We live as though we can own stuff and hold on to it and that won't change at our most extreme. So every single person in this room knows about the truth of impermanence and change. all of us. We see it in our bodies, we see it just when we walk around, walk outside, perhaps see our parents getting older, that type of thing. It's the truth of impermanence and change. And it's unstoppable. Unstoppable. That's why in the meditation before, I was asking you to notice things changing. We tune in to this fundamental truth in a very, very basic way with our own experience. Did you want to ask something there? Oh, okay.
No, nothing.
I just saw a few hands move. No? Yes, no? Okay. Yeah, don't move because I'll ask you a question. So this change is foundational to all experience. And our task in Buddhism, in terms of the Buddhist practice, is to notice that within ourselves. This is in part what the meditation practice is about. So let me read you a slightly longer part of the Lokavipatti Sutta that I read before about praise and blame. This is just the first verse. It goes like this. Gain and loss, status and disgrace, censure, that's being told off, censure and praise, pleasure and pain. These conditions among human beings are inconstant, impermanent, subject to change. Knowing this, the wise person, mindful, ponders these changing conditions. Desirable things don't charm the mind. Undesirable ones bring no resistance. These conditions among human beings are inconstant, impermanent, subject to change. Knowing this, the wise person, mindful, ponders these changing conditions. So, as the Buddha says here, we need to ponder. So the meditation is not just about focusing on our personal experiences. It's about thinking about, as we are tonight, thinking about some of these fundamental issues and how they affect us, what they mean for our relationships, our relationship with ourselves, and our relationship with people around us and with life. So, for example, very obvious examples. If we try and hold on to, let's say we get a new car. Has anybody had a new car here? Anybody? I have. And it's fantastic, isn't it, when you first get it? It's shiny and it's new and it smells good. And we're desperate to hang on to that. And has anybody had a new car and they remember their first scratch? In the car park? Yeah? And it's, oh my goodness, you know. And what's underneath that? Well, a whole lot of things. But one of the things is that we've treated this thing as though it won't change. Our desire for it. We have a view, in fact, that it should always be pristine and perfect. That's how we'd really like it to be. And sometimes we go one step beyond that. Say, if I just look after it, and if I never park in a car park, so forth, it won't change. And however, that view turns out mostly to be wrong. Sooner or later, you know, something happens to our new car. Or maybe something doesn't happen, but it just ages. It loses the new car smell, things stop working, you know. The air conditioning's not working very well in my car. It's not even 3 years old. So, you know. But I could hold an extreme view. That should never happen. I could get very wedded to that and say, that shouldn't change. So there's some connection between noticing impermanence and holding on to views. When we cling on to something, what does that mean? We want it to be solid. We want it to be real. We don't want it to change. We say, this is reality and it's unchanging. And just a moment's thought tonight, we know that's not true. And yet that is the way we are with views. It's my view. Sometimes when we have an argument, we say, it's my view that X, Y, and Z. But we don't necessarily allow the other person to have a view. It's like, no, it's my view's right. Think about the marriage equality debate at the moment. Talk about a thicket of views, a tangle of views, and people getting very upset. Tony Abbott got headbutted down in Hobart just the other day by a guy who supposedly held a slightly opposing view. Actually, the truth is he just didn't like Tony Abbott, apparently. But so he clearly held a view that Tony Abbott is a bad person. He's been very clear about that if you've read the papers. It's a very extreme view, and extreme views can lead to violence. You know, what's he saying? You should be like me, and I won't tolerate another sort of view. Some people would say that violence is okay in a righteous cause. Many people would say that. You know, that people that see things that we think would be dreadful, they will see them as a righteous cause. Suicide bombers would be a great example, wouldn't they? you know, clearly they believe truly they're doing a good thing. And their view to us seems extreme. So there's a proposition under all those views that says, these views that I hold should be permanent and they should be shared by everybody. They should be universal. And of course, once we hold that, we're not noticing the truth of impermanence. We're caught up in this thicket of views, this tangle of views. So the second fundamental idea, the first one was impermanence. The second, I think, fundamental view coming out of Buddhism, and what holds all these views in place, actually what underlies a lot of the extremity of the views, is the craving built around the search for a self-identity, for a solid sense of me. A me that I like. This is the inner selfie, you know, the one that I can show to the world. And we get very caught up with this notion of who I am, who I want to be, how I want to be, and how I want to be seen. And we crave after a particular sort of self. But more than that in Buddhism, it's said that what we actually crave is not just a projection, a selfie. What we actually crave is permanency, unchanging, a real solid sense of me. So, again, you know, I work in palliative care, I work as a bereavement counsellor. One thing I've noticed over the years is that when people have had a very close relationship and maybe they haven't had too many friends, they naturally get a lot of support from their, let's say it's their partner. Now, when that partner dies, it's as though that person loses something of their shape. They, you know, their partner has sort of held them in place and given them a shape. I am a husband, I'm a wife, I'm all these things. And we lose those self-boundaries. And what's craved is to go back to that sense of self that we're very, very comfortable with, that we probably hadn't thought about too much, but feels like it's me, fundamentally me. And it's often when we hit one of those crises that we come to feel that our belief in this fundamental me is really shaken. Oh, who am I now? I mean, if you couldn't study anymore, if something happened to you, that might really affect your view of yourself, the sense of yourself as a student. Because we do label ourselves. What's the first thing we say when we meet people at a party? What do? Pretty much, oh, I'm a student at UNSW. I'm getting lots of HDs. we never say that we're failing, do we? you know, I'm a bereavement counsellor. Well, that's what I do. Is it what I am? And this is really fundamental to Buddhism, beyond just how we project ourselves. That's important, clearly. But underneath that is this sense that I exist in and of myself, by myself, as something solid and somehow unchangeable. Any thoughts? Cause this is, I think this is really, really cutting to the heart of what we're talking about now. So any thoughts about that or things to add to that at all? Have you noticed that for yourselves? This sense of, oh, this is me, just feels like me. But if we think about it for a moment, what would happen if something happened to us and we couldn't be that sort of me? I wonder how we go with that. People who have been very famous and lose their fame, they think, I'm a famous person and I'll always be famous, is the underlying thought. But what happens when they're not famous? Who are they then? We know that really great sports people often suffer huge bouts of depression when they have to leave their sport. Because they're no longer a great sports person. Who are they? They've defined themselves through their activity. And this touches on something of this notion of self underneath that pushes us along, that we crave to have in a certain shape, to hold, to be, to own. This is me. So this is attachment to what some people have called a self project. This is me, the Michael that I feel is a project that somehow is real. And we get very attached to this. So at the heart of extreme views, I think, is addiction to a sense of self. I am my views. And what's extreme is the tenacity, the grip with which we hold on to our views. It's like glue. And, you know, you must have met people who hold views that they can't hear anything else. Their view is the correct view, and you're not allowed to have a view. You may know these people. What's driving that underneath is an addiction to this self. I am my views. And from a Buddhist perspective, this is inherently painful because it's built on a misunderstanding of what's fundamental, and that is impermanence. That even the sense of self is changing over time to some extent. We can't actually pin it down. Where is it? You know, bring it out and show me the self that's real. Where would that be? So if we're caught up in this self-delusion, and by definition, all of us are because we're not the Buddha, all of us think there's a me. That's how we feel. You know, we're not fully enlightened yet. Then we're going to suffer a little bit at least from being caught up with a sense of self. Because we crave to have the right sort of self. We want to hang on to it and make it solid and real. So how do we manage this? What do we do about this? You know, what's the answer to this extreme grasping onto this sense of self that really doesn't exist in the way we'd like it to? Well, one path that people walk very commonly these days is to go and see a psychologist or counsellor and work through some of these issues. Really important, very helpful, very useful it can be for some people. And so people walk the path of psychology. Well, also in Buddhism, people walk a path. We know there's a path and people walk that path. And psychology and Buddhism do share a bit in common, actually. We want to cultivate skillful ways of being in the world. We'd like to be happier. We'd like to be kinder to others, perhaps. So these are all shared across religions and across some psychologies as well. So, and Buddhism shares that as well. So is Buddhism just another psychology? Is that all it is? And I think, given what I just said before, Buddhism actually adds something extra to this mix. And what it adds, at least, is these two fundamental ideas we've talked about. One, that things are impermanent, changing, ceaselessly changing, arise because of causes and conditions and pass away. And as such, we are not the owners of those things. And psychology, it touches on that, but doesn't, I think, go deeply into this sense of what we call not-self or non-self. Anatta, not self. That wherever we search for a solid sense of self, it's not there. And in fact, I would say that most of us run a million miles from wanting to know the truth of not self. Why? Because if we start to have an intuition that maybe I don't exist as solidly, you know, that I don't own myself, as it were, as much as I thought I did, we can feel anxious about that. So many of the people that I see feel anxious because their sense of self has been shaken and the world shakes with that, and anxiety is a natural response to feeling shaky when we're not quite sure about ourselves and who we are anymore. So I actually think that it's much easier in a sense to go towards a psychology, because psychology doesn't necessarily challenge that. It wants to pack the self back into a certain sort of shape, but maybe a better shape. Ultimately, for people who are meditation practitioners, and that's not everybody, what we're exploring is how real that self is. Where is it? Who is me? These are difficult questions, and they're not for everybody, but it's good to know that this is what underlies some of these extreme views the Buddha is talking about. We could say about psychology that what it wants us to do is to adjust to the culture that we're in. Do you remember in Buddhism, the Buddha said this, that practicing the Buddhist path is swimming against the stream? Do you remember that? Swimming upstream. It doesn't necessarily go along with accepted cultural ideas. So whereas psychology might want to help us fit into culture, Buddhism might actually challenge that and say maybe there are other ways of approaching this. We live in a consumerist society. There's no doubt, is there? We like to buy things. We like to own things. Those things are us. We are our things. You know, I am my shiny car. There was a teacher called Krishnamurti, not a Buddhist, but a really beautiful teacher, and he said this: it's no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. It's no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. Now, you might think a consumerist society is okay, but you may not too. So is the goal of Buddhism just to make us adjust and live better within the culture? Well, yes, that is a part of it. It is a part of becoming better, kinder, more skillful people. But there's more. It's not just another psychology, something that wants to just make us feel better about ourselves in the world, make us better consumers. I don't think Buddhism's ever really been interested in making us into better consumers, you know, saving the world through consuming. So, impermanence and not self, the sense of ownership maybe. And so we can see from that that what underlies this notion of extreme views is, to some extent, the desperation with which we hold to those views. And the reason that's problematic, apart from any pain it causes other people or causes ourselves, is because it's based on a misunderstanding of how things are. We cannot grasp onto those things. And the more tightly we try and grasp, the more the world is going to upset us, because the world will not agree all the time to those views. What we're essentially saying is, I want everybody to be the same as me, to think like me, to act like me, to always know what's going on for me so I always get back what I want. And so it's this clinging and craving, once again, tanha, thirst, this desire to hold on to these wrong views, as Buddhism would call them, that to some extent makes them extreme. Underneath that, of course, and this is a topic for another night, is the sense that then holding on to these views is a cause of suffering, because it comes out of misunderstanding, which is where I started the talk, not seeing clearly. It causes suffering and pain. Now, if we think that's okay, then by all means, cultivate extreme views, hold on to them, be enmeshed in them, become your views. But if we're concerned, at least to some extent, about causing suffering and maybe feeling suffering, you know, being on the receiving end of a headbutt because somebody doesn't like our views, our extreme views, then it should give us pause to think about how tightly we hold on to views. My own feeling is we must have views in the world. We have views, but can we hold them lightly? So what are we to do about this? Let's say we've established something about what constitutes the extreme views in Buddhism and getting caught in extreme views. How can we notice when we're caught up in these views, when we're clinging very tightly, like a monkey hanging onto a bit of fruit, you know? How can we know when we're doing that? Well, pretty easily, actually. Notice when we feel agitated. You know, if we're talking to somebody and we're starting, you know, in yourself, you're starting to get a bit agitated. It's really useful if you can do that, to take a few breaths and go, well, that's interesting, I'm feeling agitated. What's going on here? And it may well be that we're feeling oppositional to that person because they're putting forward something that we disagree with. That's okay, nothing wrong with that. But then the degree of our response probably tells us how tightly we're holding on to our view. Now, that's not to say that everything is okay and all views are okay. Clearly, from a Buddhist perspective, that's not the case. Views that lead to suffering are not okay. They're unskillful. And we want to practice what's skillful. So first of all, noticing when we become agitated. Now, I said that's easy. The challenge is we don't like to notice that. We don't like the feeling. We try and stop it. How do we try and stop it? Well, when we have extreme views, we try and force the other person to believe our views. You know, you've seen people having stand-up arguments about marriage equality. You know, it's only if I can just yell loud enough that person will accept my views. Has anybody ever seen that happen, really? Yeah. I don't think so. You know, it's my voice is louder than yours, so, you know, my views must be right. So we can notice the vehemence, the strength with which we push back can tell us something about how we're holding on to views there. And that's an extreme form of agitation, which is actually painful for us. So the proposition here is that agitation on the inside, the feeling of agitation, of contraction, of tightness, of muscular tightness, is stressful. It's painful. And, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, we need to open up to that. We need to see it. We can also see when there's no opposition, when in fact there's a harmony. And that may suggest to us that, you know, we're not in opposition with the person and maybe we even agree about views, but how much more interesting and challenging to hold different views and not feel agitated. Now, there's a challenge. You know, there's awakening up there, but then there's that one as well. You know, to have different sorts of views but not get upset because other people hold different views from us, and not to get into the extremity of grasping onto our views so they become like a big stick to hit other people with. That's a sort of a tough ask. When we do that, the other thing maybe to notice is when we're really caught up, check and see. I'll put it out there as a proposition, but check and see how much of myself, my self-image, my sense of my self-okayness is caught up with this view that I'm putting forward. How much of me is invested in this? How much does it mean to me if people disagree What's the effect on me? You notice me is at the centre of all those sentences there. The I becomes very solid, you know, and very oppositional, very tight, and actually quite painful, I think. Meditation is fabulous because it starts to unravel that a bit and loosen us up around those. And we start to just tune into the fundamental way things are, which is the truth of impermanence. See what it feels like when you think you should have got an HD and the examiner says, no, not worth an HD. I did a master's a while back, and my supervisor, God bless him, gave me a really good mark. The external examiner gave me a really low mark. And I spent a long time, you know, it's much better than this, I shouldn't have got that. You know, my view was that it was better than the other examiner said. Quite rightly then, the head of the college came in and actually chose the middle path and gave me like the middle mark, which is very skillful actually in the circumstances, and actually it was about right. But it was interesting to see myself, my self-image, my craving for a good mark come up. So the HD is not just directed at you, it's also directed at me. But see what it's like when we don't get what we want, basically, and see how the sense of self gets involved. And that's when mostly we can see it very clearly. When everything's pleasant, we don't notice because everything's pleasant. We're just going along with it, you know. We're fabulous when everything's pleasant. But we actually see this oppositional view, self, this self with extreme views, the self that really wants to hang on and, you know, present itself in a certain sort of way. We see it when we're in opposition. We have different views to others. So what I thought I might do, just for a few moments, is just ask you some questions that help might help clarify ways of thinking about this, ways of investigating how we might know if we're getting caught up in views built around a self. So you're willing to have a go at that? You don't have to speak up. It's an internal silent thing. Yeah. And then we'll have some conversation after that. Okay, so if you're okay about it, just let your eyes close, and this will be 5 minutes worth of self. It's a contemplation, really, rather than the deep meditation. So let your eyes close, and maybe just take a couple of deeper than usual breaths, just to let the body settle. So a big in breath, and the out breath, and again the in breath, and the out breath. Just feel the body settle quite naturally. The sensations throughout the body, sitting, touching, breathing. Just as we did before. So the first question we can silently contemplate for ourselves is, how would I feel, or how have I felt or react if I don't get what I want? So try and think of a situation where you haven't got what you wanted, and it may be something about study, it may be something else in your life, something you felt you deserved. See if you can bring that to mind, and then really just contemplate, how did I feel at the time? What was going on? Was it pleasant or unpleasant? And noticing as you're feeling your way into that, remembering that, and your own reactions, how you felt as a self, as a person. Did you feel challenged? Did you feel under threat? Did you feel angry and want to lash out? And if you're able to, just noticing if there is a strong sense of self, of me, of mine, and what's rightfully mine, and what should be happening in that recollection. Asking ourselves another question now, letting go of that. When we have those reactions, which we all have, are those reactions I'm having, those views that I'm holding, are they for short-term gain or long-term benefit? When we have those reactions, thinking of the situation you just brought to mind, were you thinking about your long-term welfare or was it a short-term benefit, just getting what we wanted in the present moment, being acknowledged, feeling better about ourselves? We can ask ourselves the question, are these extreme views, or when I get caught up in views, do they benefit me in the long term, or do they benefit others in the long term? Not just today, not just now, but over weeks and months and years. So we're noticing the view that we held, and we're noticing our reactions. And then we're contemplating, what's the effect of those views and those reactions? Does it cause pain? Does it lead to well-being? Does it lead to well-being here and now? And does it lead to well-being into the future? A calm mind, peace, happiness. And in our minds, if we remember that we have hurt somebody with our views, or indeed hurt ourselves, to bring a sense of kindness and share it towards that other person, but also towards ourselves, because when we have extreme views and we get caught, the person who is hurt also is ourselves. We become the attacker and the victim. Forgiving ourselves, making an intention to do better next time, to act more skillfully in the future for the welfare of other people and also for ourselves. When we feel ourselves holding on to views, to just release a little around them, to let be. Really bringing a sense of kindness to yourself and to others that you might have hurt. And allowing the eyes to open and coming back to the room. So I'll finish with a little verse from the Buddha, just to finish off that verse from the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. The Buddha talked about the extremes of addiction, the addictive extremes. So he says, avoiding both of these extremes, all the extremes we've discussed, the middle way realized by the Tathagata, this is the Buddha, producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening. And what is the middle way realized by the Tathagata? That producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. Precisely this noble eightfold path. Right view, right resolve, that is right intention. Right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This is the middle way realized by the Tathagata, that producing vision, producing knowledge, leads to calm, to direct self-knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. So if we have a notion that we're walking on the path and we're practicing particularly that middle section, right livelihood, right speech and so forth, then we are practicing relaxing around holding on to extreme views. And underneath all of that is just having the intention of non-harm. It's really quite simple when it comes down to it. Not harming others, not harming ourselves. Understanding these two fundamental principles of impermanence, of change, and what happens if we try and grasp onto things, including a sense of self, when it's actually impossible to do that. It's like sand going through our fingers. It's simply impossible to do that. It's futile, and it causes harm to ourselves, pain to ourselves and others. So we'll pause there for a moment, and I'll turn it over to you guys and see if there's anything you'd like to talk about, add from your own experience, questions you'd like to ask. Yeah, please.
So we talked about addiction, right? Attachment,
yes.
To things like, for example, getting ADHD, no exams.
Yeah.
But, like, is it necessarily a bad thing? Because, for example, if you don't get it, yes, there might be disappointment, right?
Yep. Yep. Yep.
But that also motivates us to do better, right? Like, we study harder because of that.
It can do, yes, that's right. So this is exactly the question, isn't it? Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Is it useful or not useful to want to get an HD? What do people think about that? Just given what we've been talking about, what do you reckon? Good or a bad thing?
Not good, not bad.
Not good, not bad, okay. I'm here in the middle path here. Can you say something about that?
It's
so complicated, yeah. Well, look, what about other people? Any thoughts about that?
Like one example. Last time when I studied my degree,
yep.
I got one subject called law engineer.
Yeah.
It's a lawyer la, actual one. He asked us a question. Last time the UK dropped a bomb, atomic bomb, to the Hiroshima and
yep.
the Nagasaki.
Yep.
That one throw a bomb, kill people, but it could save their army. So is it good or bad?
It's a great question. It's essentially the same question, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just more extreme, that's all. From a Buddhist perspective, that's clearly not a great thing to do because it's causing harm. But nevertheless, the fundamental principle is the same. Given what we've talked about, any thoughts about that at all? Any ways finding a way through?
Wouldn't that depend on how you respond and how that affects you as a
person? I think so, yeah. So do you want to say something about that? So how might that be managed skillfully?
Like, for example, if the way that it was influencing you was that it would make you really depressed and you feel like you're worthless because you're not achieving that HD that you wanted,
yes.
I would say that that's counterproductive.
Yes.
But if it was the other way around and that motivated you to strive harder for your next exam, then that would be good.
Yes, yeah.
But in a way, we can't really control how we respond to things like this.
It's a great thing. That's right, yeah. And that's a really good observation that our responses, our reactions just come up, don't they? You know. But then there's a second level of that. And once we've seen what our reaction is, what do we do with that? You know, if we feel that anger's coming up or we feel that there's depression or, you know, we're giving up or we're angry with the lecturer or whatever it happens to be, what do we do with that? And this is really where we come down to the practice. It's do we keep indulging in that? Do we keep practicing that? Do we practice being angry? Remember at the start I said about what we practice, we become good at? We can practice being angry and get really good at it. And underneath the sense of anger is the sense that I didn't get what I wanted and I didn't get what I should have got. So you're right, we have all these reactions. We like things and we want more of them. We don't like them and we try and push them away or get away from them. And so the Buddha acknowledged that. That's very, you know, it's talked about a lot in the suttas. But then all the stuff that comes after that, all the stories that go through our head about that stupid examiner and can't they see this is a real quality? Look, theirs wasn't as good as mine. Mine's better than theirs for it, you know. We can play that game for a long time. That's the level, I think, where we have some say over what we do. You know, of course we're going to feel a certain way and probably not feel very good about not getting the mark we want. But what do we do with that? Are we cultivating anger? Are we cultivating depression and everything else in between? So underneath that is what makes it useful or not useful is the degree to which the self gets involved and we start really cultivating and getting caught up with this sense of self, I. So, you know, we could have the discussion about is wanting one HD a good or bad thing? And again, we could spend a lot of time just talking about that. It's not really the issue. The issue is, what are our reactions to that? What do we do with that? How do we respond? Can we respond rather than react? Can we be a bit more intelligent and skillful about it? And of course it can be motivating. That's not a bad thing. But equally, we could get caught up with the idea that, you know, I'm an HD student and I'm motivated to get HDs all the time. And that could then become who we are.
Also the ego and pride.
Yeah, ego and pride can definitely be involved,
exactly,
and
like
that's self.
Some got the HD and then
yes.
Might be thinking, oh, I'm well above the others.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I'm much better than other people, yes. Well, look at me holding my paper where I, you know, got an HD.
I think all the time we still have to monitor our thoughts.
Yeah, yeah.
Which direction.
So the idea here is that we need to monitor, to pay attention to what's going on the inside, really our thoughts and reactions. Definitely, yeah. And that's the nature of insight meditation, of seeing into what's actually going on for us. Not necessarily the way we want things to be, but what's really going on here and now. And is it for my benefit? Is it for others' benefit? Or is it really more built around a sense of self and how I want to see myself? And does it cause me to hang on to this tightly to this sense of me? You know, because again, if we practice that, we get good at it. We'll be really good at that. How's that sounding? Yeah, yeah. So aim for an HD by all means. But, you know, how lightly can we hold it? If, you know, in a way, if we don't get what we want, how quickly can we just release around it and just go, well, this is the way it is. This is just reality for me now. And that's probably a sign of good mental health and good, you know, Buddhist mental health. Can we just release very easily when things happen? It's a challenge.
I think my opinion, that's my view, but okay.
Yeah. But views, we need views. You know, it'd be hard to work without views.
I think also in Buddhism, I think a lot of what Buddha focused on is probably not on what's good or what's bad, mm-hmm. because the Buddha, I think, he says what's good and what's bad is relative to the causes and conditions around.
Yeah.
So what he usually states is what is wholesome and what's unwholesome.
Correct.
Or what is skillful and not skillful.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So those ones are actually, because when we talk in terms of like whether getting HD is good or bad, then I think what the Buddha trying to make a point here is also that as so long as we get stuck or get caught in like the fluctuations of the world, like, you know, self-pride and, you know, no pride. And, like,
sure, yeah, and yeah.
All that,
yeah.
We are still in cycle of suffering.
Yep.
And so long as we get the cravings or desire for existence, the power tanha, we are then subject to rebirth. But that's getting very physical, but yeah.
And I agree completely. I think people are nodding as you're saying that. And there are different views about rebirth, about whether it's over many lifetimes or whether it's here and now. One way of thinking about rebirth is that, in fact, it happens every moment. And if we practice being a selfish person or a person who's caught up with ourselves in some sort of way, then that's the rebirth we get the next second, the next second, the next second. We become what we practice. So absolutely. And the Buddha does use the words wholesome and unwholesome, skillful, unskillful. Mind you, under that is a question of, well, what is skillful? What's unskillful? What's wholesome and what's unwholesome?
I think in that sense, I think the Buddha mentioned was the consciousness that's attached to lust, anger, or delusion is unwholesome, and the opposite is wholesome.
Yeah. So it's the attachment that brings us down into, again, this misunderstanding of how things are. Those things glue us to life, and they cause suffering. Yeah, because the other things are opening and releasing. Yeah. So, you know, to be skillful, to be wholesome, is a view. But it's a view that leads to the ending of views, really. It's a view that leads to liberation. It's a view that leads to the end of attachment to views, anyway, let's put it that way. You know, things are just the way they are. Yeah, it's well said, thank you. Other thoughts at all? Yeah, please, up the back, yeah.
What I've been noticing recently is that I'm not sure about others, but I personally tend to project my views on top of people, especially my expectations of how people should be.
Yes, yes.
And like in a way that's leading to me expecting certain things when that shouldn't have been the case. Like for example, say you were expecting like flowers on Valentine's Day and you don't get it.
Yeah.
And then you'll feel disappointed, but then when you think about it, like there was no obligation for that to happen in the first place, but that leads to your disappointment.
Yes, yes.
So I was wondering, like, what you think about that and how we could sort of get away from that habit.
Yeah. Look, I think the first thing is doing what you're doing, precisely what you're doing, which is to notice what's actually going on. That's always got to be our starting point. What's really going on for me? Let's be truthful about this. Sometimes really beautiful things are going on. Sometimes they're really not so beautiful things. So there's a reaction which is causing you suffering to start with, isn't there? You didn't get the flowers on Valentine's Day, and that's really disappointing because you had an expectation that you would. But the question, I think, for us is, what do we do with that? First of all, do we notice that, or do we just react and get on the phone and go, you didn't, and I expect them, and I've got a view that I'm valid. You know, end of relationship. or beginning of a very bad relationship. So we could do that. Or We can be very truthful and go, hang on, what's going on? Something doesn't feel right. Something feels painful, unsettling, upsetting for me here. How much of this is mine? How much of this is theirs? You know, if a promise was made and that wasn't carried through, okay, that would be something different again. And sometimes the investigation does tell us certain things need to be done by us out in the world. It reveals that maybe something isn't going right in the relationship and we need to maybe say something about that. But if it's much more from our side and just this weight of expectations, these views that we've held, and if we're the ones that's suffering, that's a pretty good incentive to try and do something different. You know, mostly we tend to just go off and do what we're going to do anyway, which is usually to yell or to get depressed or complain, bitch, moan, all that sort of stuff, you know. But we can intervene there. And the earlier that we notice the beginnings of the reaction, the easier it is to intervene. When it's full-blown, when it's a tsunami, you know, really there's no getting out of that until it just finally subsides, you know. So if we can intervene beforehand and notice the conditions on the inside, then it does give us more choice. And it's like anything, if we practice that, practice noticing and then just releasing a bit of, around those big reactions, then we get better at it. That becomes a skill as well. So it's precisely what you're doing, I think. And the reflecting on it, like we've just done now, the pondering, as the Buddha called it in that sutta, is really important. To think about what's actually going on is incredibly important as well. Does that speak to what you're saying? Well, it sounds like you're doing it anyway, you know, but yeah. And the more we start to wake up to that, the easier it gets too, I think. Yeah. But as I said, just to say it one more time, sometimes self-reflection, whether it's meditative or more contemplative, does reveal to us that certain things need to change and certain things might need to be said, and becomes quite practical then. But then we can act skillfully, hopefully, to bring about those changes. No,
back to the example that was brought up, the extreme example about the bomb.
The bomb, yes.
Yeah, like also the paradox of, like, you know, you kill someone to save someone else, like.
Oh yes.
Is there like middle path approach to it? Because, you know, killing is obviously bad, but, like, there's no, like, diplomatic way to solve it.
Yeah.
For example, in the war, like, will you kill 1,000 soldiers to save another? Like, what would be the middle way solution?
Yeah.
You can't kill 500 to save.
It's a great question.
50,000, obviously.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. What do you think? Is it okay to kill 10 people to save 20? What do you reckon? What would the Buddha say? If we're so bold as to try and think what the Buddha might say, what might the Buddha say? Is it okay to do it or not? What about if we kill 10 people to save 100? Is it about the number of people?
But this is also based on personal view as well, right?
Personal
view,
yeah.
On whether to, like, whether you label the 20% as a good person or the 20% as a bad person.
It's a great point. Yeah. So how do we see those people we're going to kill? You know. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And still kill them at the end.
What if they're good people? Yeah. But we're going to save 100 good people by killing those. There's a classic example that's given in Burma, and it comes from the Visuddhimagga, and it's a bit of a trick question, this one, really. And it goes something like this. Let's say that you are going on a trip somewhere and you're travelling with a few other people. So it's you. Some of you will know this already because it's a classic example. You've got a friend. You've got a respected teacher with you, a monk or a nun perhaps, you know, or a lecturer who gave you HD. you know. You've got somebody that you're having a few problems with. You've got a neutral person. Somebody you really don't know has just joined the group for the travel to and from. And then you've got somebody you really dislike. And then these bandits come out of the hills and they capture you. And for some odd reason, they say to you, all right, you, they choose you, and say, choose. We're going to kill one of you to make a sacrifice for whatever reason, and then we'll let the rest of you go. You choose who's going to die. Now I'm going to ask you that question. Now I'm going to ask you to answer, and I want to see every hand come up on this one. And I'm going to go, have a think who you choose. Would you choose yourself? Would you choose your friend because they'd understand? Would you choose the person you don't know? Would you choose the respected teacher? Maybe they'd understand. Would you choose the enemy? Everybody always thinks of Hitler. I don't know why, but anyway. But so here we go. Who would, and taking this seriously, who would put themselves forward? Show of hands, yep. Okay. So, yeah, it's a tough one to answer. It's a bit of a fake question, but nevertheless. Okay. Who would choose the friend? Yep, friend. Beware. I won't ask you for your reasons. We haven't got really enough time, but it would be curious if we had more time to ask, to think about that. Who would choose the respected person, the teacher, maybe the monk or the nun? Yeah, right. Okay, one brave person over there. Who would choose the neutral person, the person you don't really know? Yep, okay. Who would choose the difficult person, the one you're having challenges with? Anybody? And one last question, who hasn't put their hand up? Who would you two choose?
Myself.
You choose yourself, Chris?
I'd ask whether I could choose the bandit.
That's the first time I've heard that answer, right? We're swapping places, you're coming out the front to give the talk. Look, and the traditional answer is that if you're coming at this with the heart of loving kindness and equanimity and compassion, you couldn't actually choose anybody. Now, you may be satisfied with that, but it's actually making a point about how we stand and how we balance ourselves in relation to other people. You know, if you think somebody else is a bad person, it is much easier to do harm to them, like the guy who headbutted Tony Abbott. You know, it's a very extreme thing to do. So clearly it's easier to harm people that way. But if we have this heart that's open to everybody, including those people with extreme views that we don't agree with, it becomes far more difficult to make that decision. You know, and this maybe is an example of what I was talking about before. The practice of Buddhism may lead us against the way the culture thinks. Because many people in the culture, in the world, would say, well, of course you have to make that decision. We drop the bomb, as they did. We shoot these people. We blow up a supermarket or a railway tunnel or something like that. But it may be that Buddhist practice makes those questions far more difficult to answer. It's swimming against the stream. It shouldn't make us indecisive or passive, but it may at least cause us to pause and reflect more deeply on how to answer precisely that sort of question, which in a sort of way for some people would seem very obvious. Of course, if it's 10 people, I'm saving 1,000, of course we'd kill the 10. You know, what about if you had to hold the gun and shoot them personally? If you could drop a bomb from a great height, it would be much easier, wouldn't it? But if you've got to do it personally, it becomes more difficult because then they become real people. So Buddhism opens us up to our connection with people and you know, it's harder to hold extreme views when we feel connected with people. So the sense of connection gets cultivated in Buddhist practice. As we open up to ourselves, we open up to others. And it's much harder to hold extreme views and brutalise ourselves and others because we feel that. And correspondingly, it's far more challenging to make these sorts of decisions, I think anyway. Great question, thank you, yeah, for your response too. Yeah.
So, like, recently, I keep on, like, observing myself, I guess.
Yep.
And, and it's just that I feel like, because I feel like, oh, I'm attached to, like, these things. And I try to, like, kind of stop it.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But the thing is, I don't know if, like, it's a good thing to do that, or should I just, like, observe it and just, like, notice it and, like, just let it be?
Yeah, look, it's a great question, thank you. Yeah, and it's difficult to know sometimes what to do. And, look, sometimes when we're starting to begin to notice how we react and what's going on, we start to notice at a very gross level. We start to notice the tsunami. That's often when we tune in, oh, my God, this is really painful. What's going on? And sometimes at that point it does need some sort of stopping activity. We just stop. You know, and sometimes it feels a bit tight or a bit brutal. So that's, but maybe that's a starting point. It's like learning anything. We don't know how to do it. It's like if we learn to swim, you know, we're thrashing around, putting in 100 times the amount of energy that's needed. And gradually as we get skillful, we can put in less and less energy. We know how to do it. Similarly with this, as you just keep in tune with yourself, what you will notice is the beginnings. You get close to the beginning of some of those reactions, and it's not as strong. It's not such a big story. You know, sometimes you've been walking along, and it's almost like you wake up and you come out of the story and go, well, where the hell was I? Has anybody driven from point A to point B, you know, from home to university, or got public transport many, many times? And has anybody ever got to university and go, how the hell did I get here? I don't remember a thing. which is pretty disturbing when you're driving a car. And what does that mean? It means we're caught up in the self story. Who's at the centre of our stories? Even when it's full of other people, it's all about us. It's only us. It must be us. We're the ones doing it. And that's the sort of thing normally we start waking up to that almost after the event, when we're feeling really yucky and, oh, I'm really involved in this whole story in my head. So once we start to see that pattern and see that it's not very pleasant, or it's not useful, maybe not skillful, not wholesome, we can begin to start to feel when it begins to happen. You know, so we intend to pay attention, and we start to wake up a bit earlier to it. And then the stopping, that sort of heavy-duty stopping, slamming on the brakes of whatever reaction we've had, it becomes easier, and it's not so heavy-duty, because it's not so big anymore. Does that make sense? Is that speaking to what you're saying?
Yes, but the thing is, I stop it every single time, like, I feel like, oh, I'm getting attached to something, I have to stop it. Right. But then, I don't know if it's a good way to learn, like, how to let go of this attachment.
Yes,
yeah, I see, just, yeah, like, right. Yeah, it should just be like, I don't know, in my mind, like, letting go of attachment is more of like, oh, I notice it, done.
Yeah.
But, like, I just Stop.
Let me know when that happens. You know? Look, for most of us, I think, look, practically speaking, we go back to where I started and said that this teaching, at its most extreme or intense, is for people who have become monks or nuns, really, people, you know, at that sort of level. All of us have attachments. All of us have, you know, things we like and don't like. That's not really the issue. That sort of attachment is not the problem. The issue is craving. Where one ice cream isn't enough and we need 20 more, that type of thing, you know. I'll give you an example of that. So my grandfather, who's died many years ago now, he went through a stage in later life where he got probably a form of obsessive compulsive disorder, and he would have a glass of water. And then that wasn't enough, he'd have another glass of water. And then he felt like that conditioned needing another glass of water, and that conditioned needing another glass of water. Then he'd be sick, and guess what he'd do? He would go back and have another glass of water because it was out of control. That's the sense of attachment. So attachment's a difficult word. It's not the most useful word. Craving, I think, is a better word to start with. Tanha means thirst. So my grandfather literally had the thirst, this craving for water. So if we start there, I think it's probably easier to work with that. So you like chocolate ice cream. Fantastic, you know. What do you like when you can't get it is really the question, you know. If we can't satisfy those desires, if we get caught up with it, yes, there's a problem. But if it comes and goes and we take it as it comes and as it goes, that's ideal. That's how it is. The world comes and goes because of causes and conditions. You know, and if we're comfortable with that, able to release, fine. But if we have all these conditions on life about what will make us happy and we have views about that, this is moving us more towards that sense of tightness and craving. That really is the translation of tanha. Is that speaking more to what you're saying? Yeah. So sometimes we can be very hard on ourselves. That's just another form of attachment. I crave not to be the way I am. It's you know, bawa tanha and vibawa tanha. I want all this craving. I don't want to have craving. Essentially, it's all just craving. It's just craving for different things. Yeah. So how lightly can we hold those things, really? You know, enjoy the things that come, but if they don't come, how are we? It's a great question to ask, really. And, you know, coming right back to where we started with the HD, how are we if we don't get that? You know, okay, we're upset, but how long, in fact, how much does that upset us and for how long? And what is the effect on us, and what's the effect then that we project onto other people? Is that speak to that? Yeah. So probably you could maybe lighten up a little bit and just, you know, just watch out for that intense craving, you know, which is another form of extreme view. Yeah.
What I learned from I was watching a video that was from a monk in Thailand, and he basically talked about self-hopping, attachment, like, you know, whether I should stop doing what I'm doing.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And he was actually saying something like, because our body are not self, right? Things that are not self, we can't control it. We can't tell our body is not self, right? We can't tell our body, stop hurting, I don't want to feel hurt. So it's the same as our mind, because all phenomena are not self, right? So our mind is not self also. In that sense, we can't tell our mind, stop being angry right now. We can't tell them, like, oh. So what he suggests was that the mind can only be liberated when they are when they realize that they're doing something weird or doing something wrong. So if you, I think, I from my own experience as well, is that when I, if you observe myself, it's like, oh, I'm angry. What's the use of being angry? Oh, it's useless. Then you just stop automatically because the mind's like, oh, see, that's useless. So it, they don't. So the mind just stops doing it by itself.
Yes.
When they realize something, I think, and that's also. I feel that it is the same as when the Buddha was enlightened. He feels like because everything is impermanent, not self, and unsatisfactory, there's no need for involvement into anything. And that's why it's liberation, because you're not attached to anything. But
Bear in mind there, look, that it's great, but bear in mind also the Buddha was very, very engaged in the world. You read the suttas and the Buddha's talking to kings and princes and beggars and all sorts of people. So this is not about not being in the world either. So we need to bear that in mind as well, that it doesn't make us ineffectual or in the world. We can still be more effective than ever in a way. There's probably time for another question or two, or we can please do. Yes.
Sometimes you meet people with extreme views that advocate cruelty and
suffering
for, I don't know, say maybe advocating racism or something.
Bullfighting
or something.
When
you talk to those people, how can you stop yourself getting agitated and angry?
Maybe you can't. So, no, honestly, maybe you can't. It's just what we've been talking about, isn't it? That those things come up very naturally, particularly if we're tuned in to suffering.
So I was talking to somebody of bullfighting, angry. In no way going to change their mind.
No, exactly.
You've got to try and be calm and realise it's part of their upbringing, tradition, habits.
Yeah, which is easy to do when you're not talking with them, isn't it? When afterwards, Look, at the very least, what we can do is try and be skillful in the way we're relating to them with our language, at the very least, even if we've got a hot heart at the time and we want to strike out in some sort of way. You know, that's a great starting point. Are we causing harm to them? You know, and if we're causing harm to them, we know we're causing harm to ourselves as well. So maybe just at that level, the best we can do is not to lash out.
Natural reaction is to try and cause harm to them.
Well,
maybe not physical harm.
But even to brutalise them into thinking what we think is right, which is actually an extreme view in a way. It's an extreme reaction. But it may well be that from that we go, gee, this is really important to me. I've recognised this issue really, really is deep with me, and I'm going to do something in the world about that. It might bring us to some sort of, you know, social action or ethical engagement, something like that. So it might reveal that there's more we can do because we've understood it's very important to us. We might be able to change that guy, but maybe we can work in a broader sort of way to satisfy that understanding that we have about not wanting other beings to suffer. It might reveal that we need to do more in that situation in a more considered sort of way. Do you know what I mean? We pick our time and our place. So rather than going, well, I need to change that guy, his views are wrong, maybe the best we can do is to not react, and then to, you know, live in a way, work in a way, volunteer in a way, whatever, that speaks to that thing that's moving us so deeply. Maybe that's what's revealed there. It also reveals that probably we need to work on ourselves a bit as well. But, you know, when we're in the tsunami, it's very hard to do the work. That often we see that, and that's when we go on retreat, which is a bit like a sheltered workshop, really, isn't it? You know, special conditions, and that's when we develop these more subtle skills as well. And then we keep practicing the world. So it's a sort of a back and forth thing in many ways, I think. You know, but often we do need the space to settle down, to open up, to investigate, to see what's going on more clearly, and then come up with some skillful intentions, some ways of managing, and head back out into the world again. No easy answer to that one there, I don't think. And I think it's true for all of us, actually. People are smiling and nodding as you were saying that. So I think that's just the truth for all of us. That's the challenge. And that reveals the need for the practice.
It's no matter how much to change that person.
Look, I think it's important to perhaps, you know, say the way you feel, but then can we also just let that go there and go, well, I've said what I need to say because I feel it's the right thing to say, but, the next step would be to try and force them to pick that up, and that's really not ever going to work, is it? You know, because it's trying to force them. But maybe from our side it's important to say those things. The Buddha said the things he felt were right to say, from his side. Sometimes people picked them up, sometimes they didn't. The first person the Buddha met said, "Who are you?" And he said, "You know, I'm the enlightened one, the awakened one." And basically the guy said, "Oh, that's nice," and off he went, kept going. But, you know, can even happen with the Buddha. I doubt the Buddha was upset by that, though.
In that case, how do you define if a view is right or wrong, though? Because it's a definition that we put onto it based on judgments from our perception.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
How do you? Because I might think that this thing is right, but he might think that it's wrong. So
yeah.
Who's the right one? The one that's most
supportive? Yeah. So coming back to the talk, we need to notice a couple of things there.
Yeah.
Firstly, there's how we're reacting to that. You know, are we getting caught up in that as a self? Are we hardening around this sense of self? Do we have a sense that we need to strike out verbally or to force them to, you know, believe something? So number one, we've got to start with the reaction, I think, first. And that's when we notice there's pain and suffering, okay. So from our side, we're probably clinging too strongly to it. From a Buddhist perspective, judging whether it's an extreme view or not, again, we could just from a general view go and write all these views all over the wall here, and we'd be here for the next week, what, you know, trying to figure out what's extreme and not. Does it lead away from harm? Does it lead towards harm? Is it hurtful? Does it lead towards wisdom? Very fundamental questions. Does it lead to opening? Does it lead to seeing these fundamental things about existence? Does that happen? Or does it just prolong the suffering? Does it just harden people into positions? Now, we'll probably never get to the bottom of, you know, what's right and what's wrong in terms of views, but the broader questions, the deeper questions really is, does this lead towards wisdom? Does it lead towards liberation? Does it lead towards a peaceful heart? Does it lead towards some sort of harmony in society? And if the answer is yes to those, then we're in the ballpark. We're in the Buddhist ballpark. They're much less likely to be extreme or wrong views. And you're quite right, Buddhism talks about wrong views, views that lead to away from that fundamental understanding of the nature of change and what a self is. And, you know, investigate the idea that most extreme views are built, you know, have a very strong sense of self at the centre of them. You know, different cultures believe different things. How are we to say? But are they harmful or helpful? It's sort of as simple as that in a way. We keep it simple. You know, maybe if we're the Buddha, we can be more subtle. But for us, we better start where it's simple, I think. Is it hurting or is it harming? And you know, does it lead to wisdom or not? Pretty straightforward. And that way we don't have to get caught up with, oh, that view is right, that view is wrong, well, there's a slight variation on that view, or what about this variation over here? We can begin by asking those fundamental questions. So in the marriage debate, it's sort of hard to say which is right or wrong. I mean, I have my own very particular views about that. But at the very least, we can ask of our reactions, are my reactions leading towards wisdom, away from harm, towards peace? And they're the questions we need to answer, I think. We could get caught up in a whole debate about what's right or wrong, and it's not that we shouldn't have the debate, but it's the getting caught up that's the issue, because that's the craving aspect. Yeah.
So recently I've been having a slight dilemma. So in making a decision, usually what I do would be like weighing out the pros and cons,
trying to
factor in as many things as possible.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And like choose the best option.
Yeah.
But if faced with a decision that weighing out the pros and cons doesn't really bring you anywhere, like it's quite an even scale, is there a better way to do things? Like, is there a Buddhist way?
The other thing that can help there, and there's, again, it's hard to answer that, but the thing we haven't mentioned tonight, but the Buddha emphasised very strongly, is association with good friends. That's when you ask your friends, I reckon. And finally, you have to make your best call, don't you? And the truth is, we don't know, you know, because we can't see the future. Things are impermanent; they change. We can make predictions, and there are probabilities. The sun will probably rise tomorrow, and it's probably going to be a hot day. But this is where we call on our friends, Kalyanamitta, you know, our good, skillful, compassionate, wise friends, and talk to them. You know, we're social mammals after all. And all throughout even the early suttas, they talk about good friendship. And friends help to moderate us, to guide us, to pull us up when we're maybe going in the wrong direction. It's why we're here tonight together. It's incredibly important. You know, trying to do it by ourselves is, you know, it's pretty lonely and pretty difficult, and most people don't succeed in doing that, and it's not very natural for most of us. So the Buddha, after his enlightenment, went back to the five ascetics. That was the first association with good friends, skillful friends, and so it grew from there. So maybe you could try that. You've just got to know which friends are wise and skillful, that's all. And there's only one way of finding out. Yeah. So maybe that's enough for this evening. We've covered a huge amount of ground. No easy answers, but a few, hopefully, some fundamental things to think about there. Be a bit easy on yourself sometimes. It's a practice. And like any practice, we start off with the, you know, those little bikes kids get on with the training wheels. We start with the training wheels on, and eventually we learn to balance, and so we can work skillfully. Yeah. So thank you for the invitation to speak this evening. It's been lovely to see you again. I come once a year and I always enjoy it. So I look forward to seeing you next year. Good luck with your exams. Good luck with the marks on your exams. Good luck with your practice as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.